Hello and welcome to Physics Frontiers. This is episode number 56, The Anomalous Magnetic Moment of the Muon. Show notes for this episode can be found at frontiers.physicsfm.com/56. Show notes include links to the papers we read on this program, as well as other links, such as to related previous episodes, books, or anything else we may have mentioned in the podcast. Now, Jim and Randy. Hey, Randy, what's going on?
How's it going, Jim?
It's going all right. What amazing things are we going to talk about today?
This is a topic that we've touched on privately a few times, but it's really very interesting and it's right up our alley. It's the magnetic moment anomaly with the muon.
Okay, so what's going on with the magnetic moment anomaly of the muon? So why is it interesting?
Well, the standard model makes very specific predictions about what the magnetic moment of the muon should be, just like it makes a very highly precise estimate for the magnetic moment of the electron. And experiments have been finding that the magnetic moment is different than the standard model prediction to an incredibly small degree. I think it's, I can't remember exactly, but it's like one part in a billion or something like that. It's a very small degree, but the experimental precision is so high that we know that it's a very significant deviation. They're looking at like a 3.6 sigma deviation, and like the standard for a scientific discovery, as most people know, is about 5 sigma significance. So they're working on some new experiments in order to see if this anomaly will shrink or whether they can increase its significance to the level of like a 5 sigma signal in order to demonstrate that there actually is some new physics going on. Because that seems to be the only answer if the anomaly continues, and it's continued for a long time. I'm not sure if you know exactly how far back it goes, but I know that it's over a decade. And except Brookhaven had done a bunch of experiments to try to measure the magnetic moment of the muon. And, of course, theoreticians have also been working harder to make their predictions more accurate. And they're trying to account for some very small but very important contributions from, you know, vacuum fluctuation kind of dynamics, sort of hadron light interaction contributions. So the theoreticians have been trying to get their predictions more accurate. In the same time, they're about to do, and I think they've started running some preliminary trials on a new set of experiments at Fermilab. So between these two things, we should, you know, maybe in the next year or so, find out if there's a real mystery here that doesn't conform to the standard model as we have it now, and if there may be additional particles outside of the standard model that might contribute to this magnetic moment anomaly.
Yeah, so it was the 2004 Brookhaven experiments that finally got the precision for the magnetic moment of the muon low enough that you could see something like new physics. So, you know, people have been looking at the magnetic moment of the muon for quite a long time. It's a little bit difficult to measure it compared to the magnetic moment of the electron, mainly because the muon lasts for about 2 microseconds. I mean, you can accelerate it and make it better, so you can make it last longer than that in the laboratory frame, but in its own frame, it lasts for 2 microseconds before it decays. But it's got a really great property, right? Which is, if you have a pion that decays into a muon, you know, it violates parity, and you can get different effects from the mu minus and the mu plus particles. By doing that, you can look at how they process and get some idea. So you take the mu plus, I think, is going to be in the opposite direction of the direction of motion, and the mu minus is aligned with it. And so I think it's the mu plus they use, and the precession of the muon in the magnetic field. So you shoot this muon into a magnetic field, then it basically does cyclotron motion, right? So it goes around in a circle because it's a charged particle in the magnetic field. But on top of that, the muon undergoes Larmor precession. The muon rotates then in the field as well. The spin of the muon rotates in the field as it's turning in the field, and that that changes the angle between the direction of motion and the direction of the muon.
So the precession of the magnetic moment of the muon is kind of orbiting the axial direction of motion through the cyclotron, is that it?
Basically, it precesses around the direction of the magnetic field.
And the magnetic field is in what direction?
It's perpendicular to the direction that the muon is moving.
Oh, okay, so.
Yeah, that's going to be the Lorentz force law. And so you get that cyclotron motion, which is going around the direction of the magnetic field, and then the muon is precessing around that magnetic field. I mean, this is actually very old. If you look in like Melvin Schwartz's Principles of Electrodynamics, it's on page 174 to 180, right? He describes the experiment. And it's pretty much the same experiment. There are a lot of refinements. There's a magic energy, I guess it is.
Yeah, 1.7 gigavolts, I think, gigaelectron volts.
That sounds about right. I don't remember exactly what it is. I wrote it down somewhere, but I'm not going to do the experiment, so it doesn't matter. There's sort of a magic energy there that gives you a lot better signal to noise, I think it does. And on top of that, if you can get the muons going faster, you have more time dilation, which means that you get a larger angle with more time, and then you get a better result.
I think in one of these papers they were talking about using, I think, nuclear magnetic resonance imaging sensors.
Well, they probably can use something like that.
I guess they're measuring everything, because you've got to know the exact strength of the magnetic field, right?
That's something you can more or less set. They'll have some sort of Hall probe or some other way to measure the magnetic field in there, but right. You know, they more or less set that, right? You know, after the first experiment, then the next two experiments were just making larger and larger muon collectors. And then they'd run those for years and figure things out. So the first three experiments for this were at CERN, and then the fourth, as far as I know, was at Brookhaven. And then you measure them, and I don't really know how to measure them. The paper that we looked at that was for the experimental results, do you remember what that was, the status and prospects?
Yeah, that was the status and prospects of the muon G-2 experiment at Fermi Lab. That's a 2019 paper, and I would suggest that if people want to read the papers that we're talking about here, that would be a good place to start, I think, because it gives a really good overview. It's very easy to understand. It's very concise, and it really hits on the main points.
Basically, by reading that, it sounded like it was more or less the same experiment, as well as some additional stuff that I read. It still sounded like it's the same sort of experiment, just refined quite a bit. So, you know, they've had these experiments for years. So the first one was in 1961, but basically the quantum electrodynamic calculation of this anomaly. So quantum electrodynamics predicts the anomaly. That was the thing that made quantum electrodynamics so amazing, right? Is that it predicted this difference in the magnetic moment of the what Dirac's relativistic theory of the electron produced, which was G equals 2. So when they write this G, which is the gyromagnetic ratio for the intrinsic angular momentum of an object, which we refer to as spin, should be 2 relativistically, according to Dirac in 1928. For an orbital magnetic moment, it should be 1. And then Schwinger calculated that at least the first order correction to that should be like the fine structure constant over 2 pi.
So that's the virtual particles playing a role in the...
Yeah, I guess it has to be for the first order corrections or the second order corrections or something like that. I guess that's technically the first order correction because it's one factor of alpha. That actually took 20 years to get from G equals 2 to G equals 2.002 or something like that, right? Interestingly, the first precision measurement of that was just before Schwinger predicted that that's what it would be about. So maybe there was an issue there. So in 1947 and 1948, there were two determinations of G, one of which was through the hyperfine splitting of like hydrogen and deuterium. And that was a little bit higher than what we'd expect today. And then there was another experiment that found it to be about what we expect Schwinger to be. And then Schwinger found exactly that a few weeks later.
It's always nice to know the answer before you publish your prediction.
Yeah, I don't know if you knew the answer. So that was 20 years from 1928 to 1948. By the time we got some really good measurements of this deviation in the gyromagnetic ratio, that was like 1961. So that was another 10, 13 years. And at that point, it only required a precision about, you know, 3 parts in 1,000, it looks like, according to my notes. For that, you needed the second loop corrections for QED. You know, the next experiment, you had like 300 parts per million, another factor of 10. Still, it was only QED stuff. In 1976, you know, this was like the third CERN experiment. It was 7 parts per million, and now you had to worry about some of the vacuum polarization.
Okay, so it's only in the latest domain when we get into that scale.
Yeah, so okay. In 1976, they worry about the vacuum polarization, bit of a problem with the sign error somewhere. Oh, no, that was later.
Wow, I didn't realize you'd researched the entire history of the subject.
I'm sorry. I'm talking too much again.
No, I like it. This is stuff that wasn't in the papers that we covered, so and it's good background.
So there was a problem with that originally, but they redid the calculation somehow and got it right. Then the BNL stuff.
Brookhaven National Lab.
Yeah, in 2004, got it precise enough that even with quantum electrodynamics down to the 8th loop, right? 8th order corrections, plus weak interactions, plus hadronic vacuum polarization, plus hadronic light by light stuff, that still is off by that 3.7 sigma. And that's why they think there's some new physics here, that 3.7 sigma. So this is where the new physics can show up, is because, you know, there's some problem with the standard model. Now, some of that could be some of the precision in the standard model calculations. There's still some of that available to worry about.
But that, I was reading something, I can't remember, I think it might have been about these upcoming Fermi Lab experiments, where they apparently got a whole army of the most, you know, brilliant physicists who work in particle physics on this kind of thing. And they got them all together, and they hashed out these calculations to get the most precise prediction they could possibly make from the standard model.
Yeah, well, even though they have some problems with figuring out some of the strong interaction effects, they can sort of use other data to fit it, right? Even though they can't get really good calculations from QCD, let's say. Anyways, that's how we got here, and it's possible there's new physics. Now, there was another thing in our really cool paper. I don't know how cool it is, but it has a great title, A Tale of Two Anomalies.
That's right. And the lead author on that paper has probably the greatest name I've ever come across. Did you try to pronounce it?
I probably should have practiced, because I'm not sure if there's a way to do that.
I think it's Hooman de Voodiazel.
Hooman de Voodiazel. Okay.
Yeah. It sounds like a character out of a Dr. Seuss book. I love it.
Okay. All right. They actually seem to think that because there was another experiment on the fine structure constant that changed the evaluation of some other experiments, so now there's actually a problem with the electron.
An electron magnetic moment, right. They found a difference there. They say in that paper that A Tale of Two Anomalies, it's a 2.4 sigma discrepancy. But you can see where there'd be a theoretical argument, though, right? Because if the fine structure constant changes and then you end up with the wrong magnetic moment a little bit, I think it's very small, 10 to the minus 11th or something order magnitude.
It's smaller than that. It's like 10 to the minus 14.
Wow.
So, yeah, it's not big.
Right.
Yeah, now that was an interesting paper because it had, you know, a particular idea about how this was happening, I think.
Yeah, because they thought that they could explain both of these magnetic moment anomalies using an idea for a new particle. I think they designated it phi.
Yeah, I think it's important to note that the alpha for the electron is now lower. So the alpha for the muon is higher than the experimental value for the muon is higher than the predicted value, and the experimental value for the electron is now lower than the predicted value. So now you need something that can predict both of those things. Now you've got two choices, and apparently reading this, they have other papers that, you know, just, you know, throw other ideas at the fire to see throw other ideas on the fire and see if the smoke has any answers. But those are all for different particles for the two different effects. This one has one particle. Yeah, so one scalar boson that's supposed to interact in different ways, the same effect with different things. I mean, I guess it could have some different coupling constants for the two different modes, right? one of them has a one-loop contribution. One of them has basically a two-loop contribution, although that two-loop contribution also has a new heavy fermion in it, as well as the boson.
Okay, so you're still looking at a two-particle solution.
Yeah, but there has to be a heavy fermion that's really just momentarily there, I think. So that's what the big dot in the middle, if you look at the diagram, the big dot is a heavy fermion that also contributes. Maybe that's why it's a bar Z diagram. I was going to go look up what the difference between a bar Z diagram and a Feynman diagram is. So anyways, they have these two contributions, although it doesn't really explain why one affects the electron and one affects the muon. It just says, well, if it does, then we can explain it with this one boson, which is reasonably interesting. Although it, I mean, when I see some of these things, it sounds a lot like you have a problem and you just keep throwing solutions at it and see if any of them stick.
Yeah, I mean, they did give a prediction. I think they said that this model, it could give rise to lepton pair signals in rare meson and tau decays, as well as those in electron and muon scattering processes. So they did offer some potential experimental ways that we might also be able to confirm if this model is valid, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, good. But it's no different from all the other solutions, right? All the other solutions people have.
Right, and that's where we looked at the first paper from, what was that, 2014? New physics contributions to the muon anomalous magnetic moment and numerical code.
Okay, was that just the first paper that you read, or was that the first paper on the list, or?
Well, it was the first one that I had on my notes here, because it was the oldest one that we were going to go over today. They give a list of, what is it, five different solutions, and then like eight different particles.
Yeah, they have a lot of different things. They basically go through a bunch of different ideas on what this could be. Now, this was what, new physics contributions to the muon anomalous magnetic moment, a numerical code. Quiroz and Shepard. Sometimes something like this sounds a little bit like it's not really going to answer very much because, you know, it's a numerical code. But on the other hand, what they did is they ended up doing a lot of categorizations. Now, they stayed away from a lot of specific solutions, and instead they went to more general ideas behind those specific solutions, right? You have four different possibilities for your different interactions, right? They can be a scalar, they can be a pseudoscalar, which has to do with the reflection properties. You can have a vector or an axial vector, right? The electric field is a vector, the magnetic field is an axial vector, for example. The force is a vector, the torque is an axial vector. Although these are, you know, vector gauge bosons, so those aren't torques and stuff, so they're a little bit different. But, I mean, that just tells you that they're a different kind of object, right, with different kinds of rotation properties. And then they also looked at charged and uncharged particles. These different bosons could be charged or could be uncharged. Some of them were...
Or doubly charged.
Doubly charged in some cases. But they decided they didn't want to use, you know, rank two fields, which makes sense. And they decided they didn't want to use triply charged things or anything like that. So, you know, they made some cutoffs, which are completely reasonable cutoffs because you can just keep on doing it, right, forever.
Yeah, yeah. Can you imagine damn near anything, right?
So then they went through and tried to figure out sort of what parameters and what ranges would work for this.
Yeah, how heavy these particles would have to be in each category. Yeah.
That gives you a lot of spaghetti. The diagrams have lots of little lines on them, is all I'm saying.
Oh, okay. Feynman diagrams.
But not Feynman diagrams, I guess the graphs, the plots.
Oh, okay.
So they do plots of what the deviation from two would be versus the different energies, the different masses of these different particles. But they all have the same idea behind them, which is that in some sense, these are all going to be proportional to the square of the ratio of the mass of the muon to the mass of the new particle. And that's actually something somebody, and I forget who, figured out a long, long time ago.
But they wrote it down, I think, into a Mathematica code so that, you know, anybody, any of the readers could, like, experiment with this and find their own solutions.
Oh, good, good. So they have a URL or...
See, I only saw that they talked about it. I don't remember how they provided it. Let me see if I can find it in the paper. Maybe it's at the end, like the appendix.
Oh, supplementary material 30. So if you go to link.aps.org/supplemental/10.1103/physrevd.89.095024, you can get the mathematical. Okay. Or I will put this up on the show notes. Maybe I'll put the link to that if it still works, since this is 2014. But I'll put the link up to that supplementary material.
There's actually a link embedded at the very end of the paper, right before the conclusion section, to an archive location where you can find it.
In the conclusion section?
It says here, right before conclusions, at the end of section 3, it says...
That was what I just read. It's an APS link.
Oh, it's different.
It says go to note 30, which has this link for the American Physical Society. Maybe you'll have to join if you want to look at the Mathematica code. And then you'll have to buy Mathematica. Probably joining the APS is going to be the cheaper of the two. Or you can read the paper and try to reconstruct it from the paper.
Program it yourself. Why not? The formula's right there.
Mathematica knows how to do integrals, so... Yeah, I mean, people who know how to use Mathematica, sometimes I've seen people do incredibly complicated things with two lines of code, because Mathematica's already programmed all the really complicated things into it. Hopefully it's like that, and hopefully it's not some workbook that, you know, goes on for 70 pages. You really just need to know where to put your number in, then you'll be fine. I don't know, I haven't looked at it. I don't think I have a copy of Mathematica right now.
Oh. I probably shouldn't say that. Sometimes you can find these programs if you're looking hard online. That's all I'm going to say.
So they have these plots. It's interesting that they have lots of different ways to look at this. What I'm not sure about, and maybe you can tell me if you got a good idea about how this is how does that help us when we're trying to talk about the new physics? If we can look at basically any kind of new particle and say this could be in addition to what it was.
Somewhere in one of these three papers that we're looking at today, it was mentioned that if you know the general energy range that particle might exist at, then you could start looking for a bump in your signals from a collider like the Large Hadron Collider.
Okay, so basically you make a bunch of these different predictions for different kinds of particles, and then you hope you can see these new particles, you know, in LHC data or something.
Yeah. So a lot of these energy levels are really high, though. What's the energy level at the Large Hadron Collider going up to? They keep upgrading it, so it's got higher energy levels. Because they're talking about, like, multiple teraelectron volts, you know, particles here. So you're talking about particles that would have an incredibly short lifetime and extremely high energies, right?
Yes. After upgrades, it reached 6.5 teraelectron volts per beam. So that's 13 teraelectron volts for total collision energy.
Okay, so they should be able to detect it, most of these anyway.
And I guess it shut down in 2018, and they're doing a two-year shutdown period, which means they should be opening up soon for more upgrades. I'm not sure what that's going to be. So they should be coming back for more fun for the LHC. But I'm not sure, I mean, with what they're making, does that happen? Now, I mean, they should be making muons when they smash things together. And so they probably should be getting some of these effects. So they should be seeing these things.
Yeah, the heaviest particle that I think I'm seeing here is like a 10 teraelectron volt leptoquark is a theoretical possibility.
Yeah, they've got weird things like leptoquarks. So leptoquarks are, yeah, they're hypothetical particles with fractional charges with, like, you know, one-third, two-thirds, four-third, five-third charges. They're another thing I don't know that much about. I tried reading about them a few years ago, and I didn't really get very far.
Yeah, all I know about them is the obvious is built into the name, is that it's a particle that mediates an interaction between leptons and quarks.
So maybe that'll show up. People have been looking for the leptoquarks for a while, but maybe there will be leptoquarks, and then we'll have all sorts of amazing new fun things to play with.
Are leptoquarks, did they fall out of supersymmetry? Is that where we got the idea for them?
Yeah, I don't really know where they first got the idea from anymore. I mean, I've read something about it, but I think they're one of those things that had an original purpose, and then they were just so much fun that they decided to use them all by themselves. I find all these new physics solutions that are just new particles a little weird, because if they're only showing up for these tiny little deviations in one or two places, then it seems a little odd that we see them. And especially with something like the muon. The muon doesn't really have that much energy. I mean, that's one of the reasons why we can get a good idea about the muon, is the muon still has about, I don't know, 1/8, 1/9 the mass of a proton, let's say. So when it decays, it basically decays into electrons or positrons and some neutrinos. So there aren't a whole bunch of decays, a whole bunch of signals when it decays, right? When you have the tau, it has two problems. One, it has an energy high enough so that when it decays into a whole bunch of different pions and you get a whole bunch of different interesting things. There may be more. I've only seen decays with the pions coming out of them. But whenever I see those things, they have ellipses. So it's possible that the ellipses contain a whole range of incredibly strange things. But those decays have the pions, and then they have those pions then have to decay, and you end up with a whole bunch of garbage. So when you try to like measure the anomalous magnetic moment of the tau, you'd end up with a lot of problems. Although I don't think anybody's specifically tried to measure it, as far as I know. They have some data from some other experiment, you know, sort of like we were talking about with the hyperfine splitting of an atom, let's say. That can give you an idea about what G is, right? But it wasn't really a direct measurement of G, right? So you go and you do something else to get a better measurement of it. So as far as they know, the anomalous magnetic moment of the tau has an error range that's larger than the anomalous magnetic moment of the tau. So it goes from negative 0.005 or 0.05 to positive 0.013, right? So compared to the theoretical calculation, the range is huge. Although, fortunately, the theoretical calculation is just within that range.
Oh, it is. So there's not necessarily even an anomaly there, then.
That's right. That's right. So it's not something that requires new physics or anything like that. But possibly it would be a better way to look for it, because it has all of these different decays, right? It has a lot more different channels to decay into. So that means there are a lot more ways that it could actually decay into something interesting when you measure it. On the other hand, that also makes it a lot harder to measure it. Plus, it only lasts for like 2/5 of a picosecond.
Jesus. So unless you can get it up to like, you know, nearly the speed of light, your chances of measuring anything are pretty much nil.
Yeah, you probably can't do the same sort of thing with looking at the direction the thing is pointing. Because rather than having 2 microseconds to do that, you have less than a picosecond, right? So you have less than a million times less than that. So you'd probably have to do something else.
Is a pico a millionth of a millionth?
Yes. Anyways, that's where we are with this. And I'm sorry this has been such a horrible episode.
Why do you say that?
Because I've been talking the whole time.
Oh, no. Well, you've got a lot of research under your belt on it. You did the whole history thing, and you wrote a dissertation on magnetic moments and all that. I mean, you're all over this one. So I'm glad to learn. Thank you.
You know, the New Physics Contributions paper gives a nice overview of all these things, and possibly it rules some of them out. I've forgotten because it's been a week or two since I read it. But for the most part, I don't know what I'd like with it, because I look at that and I say, these are too generic. But when I looked at
Tale 2 anomalies, where they had like a very specific solution,
I like that specific solution. So maybe that's saying something. So I looked at that specific solution and it looked reasonably tight to me, right? Obviously, it has some wiggle room in it and stuff like that, but it looked reasonably tight. I looked at the place where I went there, where I got most of that history stuff, its new physics contributions were things like Higgs doublets. That was okay. I think it has 2 Higgs doublets, so it has 4 Higgs particles. So those apparently could be a reason for this happening. Then he had a bunch of stuff about supersymmetry, how supersymmetry would deal with this, right? And that's where I started thinking, why hasn't anybody been talking about supersymmetry? That plus we were talking about those perimeter psi lectures. I was listening to some of those, and they were talking a lot about supersymmetry. And I'm thinking, why haven't I heard anybody talk about supersymmetry for 10 years?
Isn't that because the Large Hadron Collider was kind of expected to detect supersymmetric particles if they existed, and they just never showed up? So people kind of like, well, I guess that's not right.
I was thinking that was the reason, but I would have thought that the theorists would be clever enough to make the supersymmetric particles appear for the next experiment again.
Yeah, they just make them more massive. You're just not there yet. Keep looking. Build a bigger collider.
And then they had little Higgs models, which just try to minimize the amount of Higgs in there. Those other two, the second two, I didn't like so much. They seem to have some implications for this anomalous magnetic moment, but it also sounded much more like, here's some things that the theorists really love. Hopefully they show up when we make a better experiment. And maybe they will. They are more specific, but they're specific in a sort of different way. I don't know if that makes any sense. So they're specific in an interpretation, but I don't think they're very specific in their predictions. It always feels like to me.
Well, yeah, but the Higgs boson was kind of in that category too, because they didn't even really know what energy band to be looking for it in, right? Remember, they were like illuminating swaths of energy levels until they finally found it.
Well, yeah, I mean, for the Higgs, they had that problem, but they also had another problem, which was they knew for the standard model to work, there had to be that thing in there. Otherwise, things just didn't work out. So they were sure it had to be there. Otherwise, there was a major problem with the standard model.
Right. This is kind of the opposite.
These guys, when I look at them, they don't really feel like they're really solving the problem. Although, you know, you listen to somebody talk about super gravity or something like that. Always sounds like they think they have the solution, but it never really feels like it has the solution to it. It just feels like it's an explanation of why there would be a solution. These things just didn't feel as good as the generic ones in the new physics contributions, and those didn't feel as good as the fairly specific model in Tale of Two Anomalies. If I look at my markings, okay, in the notes of the new physics models, I've marked them all off by different kinds of models, right? So there are plenty of details out there if I felt like, you know, reading for the next year. I mean, there are only 81 notes or something like that. So, yeah. And most of them are on different models, that the different things. So they'll be like, here are seven that have the, you know, double charged scalar, right? And then here are another five for the charged leptons or something like that. So, I mean, there are plenty of them around here for different kinds of new physics. The question I'm asking myself is, how would I feel about that when I read the papers and compared them to the different models that I was seeing here, right? Maybe how I feel doesn't matter, but, you know, I want a level of concreteness that says, you know, I'm going to be able to measure something when I read one of these things. Sometimes it doesn't really feel like that's really what they care about.
You just got different types of physicists, right? These guys really love the theory, and they love poking around the mathematical machinery. Just try to see where there's possible, you know, a possible fit. And then there's experimentalists, you know, really love the hard data and want to know exactly where to look and what kind of decay pathway we can expect these things to pop out of and all that kind of stuff. You know, takes both kinds. I think we had a nice sample of both perspectives in these papers that we looked at here. You know, because we've got the most recent paper, which is talking about the upcoming experiments. And then we've got, you know, stuff like, you know, the new physics contributions, which is purely like kind of looking at theoretical machinery.
Oh, we've got plenty of different things to look at. So if people want to look at things, we've got things for them to look at. you're right. I shouldn't have said it that way. That's me talking about all this. I guess we've only been talking about this for an hour. Let's get down to what your questions were about this.
Well, you know, I didn't really have too many room for questions because these are all just kind of hypotheticals anyway, right? They're just kind of saying, well, to find these answers, you have to look at these kind of this parameter space with these kind of properties, you know, and then in a different regime, there's another way of looking at it. I mean, it's kind of dizzying how many different kinds of solutions you can find because you're in the Wild West. If we're seeing the first signs, this would be the first sign that something doesn't fit in the standard model at like a particle level. We have dark energy and dark matter, and that's one of the things that came up in A Tale of Two Anomalies is Hooman Davoodiazl was talking about how this may tie in with the dark sector. There's definitely new physics out there, you know, and this could tie in with that. I was also thinking when we were going over these that you know, maybe this has some tie into the whole neutrino anomaly, you know, the Anita anomaly that we talked about, you know, the decay of tau particles and that kind of thing. You know, maybe there's some kind of weird link there. It's interesting that, you know, they talk about the two anomalies, the electron magnetic moment, but we've also seen the Anita anomaly. So there's a nice range of like weird little anomalies creeping around in these really weird ways. I mean, the Anita anomaly is a pretty dramatic one. Even though they've only had like a couple signals to note it, but still that's empirical evidence. And here is this like 3.7 or 3.6 sigma deviation from the standard model predictions has persisted for all this time. So, you know, these things may be related, but it's nice to see that there are some challenges to the standard model that are beyond the simple kind of supersymmetric predictions that were being made about new particles, the Large Hadron Collider and all that kind of thing. I like these new directions to try to find new physics, you know? Yeah, they seem to think that they could get to a five sigma level, at which point, you know, I think that would really inspire a lot of theoretical work, right?
Yeah, they should be able to get to that level. I hope they do. We'll have to see how that actually works out after they do the run. And then, yeah, I mean, if they've got that, then maybe some more things here, but... You know, what are we looking at for the different problems, right? And do they all work out together? Do they have anything to do with dark matter? Do they have something to do with dark energy? Those would be interesting. It would be very cool if you had just one particle that explained it all, right? You had one very weakly interacting thing that somehow explained all of these things. I guess another thing in here would have to do with the electric dipole moment. So there are some physics reasons why there shouldn't be an electric dipole moment, but it would explain some things if there were an electric dipole moment. So that's another thing to look for, is if they ever find it, right? So it's possible that in these interactions, it will actually be sensitive to the electric dipole moment of the muon. Although for the electric dipole moment of the electron, they keep finding an upper bound, right? In this paper that I looked at from 2009 was something incredibly small. It was something on the order of 10 to the minus 40, 10 to the minus 41 coulomb meters, measure the dipole moment in. That's pretty small. And if they find one, there's a problem with time reversal symmetry, which would make it cool. That's the reason why they keep looking for it, is for some of these theories, you should end up with a small problem with the time reversal symmetry. And that is technically related to the same part of the scattering amplitude that the magnetic dipole moment comes from. So it's possible that those two are related. It's actually like the imaginary part of, maybe I shouldn't call it an amplitude. I don't know enough about it to know if that was the amplitude for that scattering thing. I'm not going to look through all the pages of the 130 page paper to figure it out. So maybe it has something to do with that. That would also have some implications for changes in the standard model if they actually found that.
Because the standard model can't accommodate anything like that, right?
Yeah, I don't think it's supposed to have that. I think it's supposed to be time reversal symmetric.
Well, I like to think that what we're seeing here is something akin to the anomaly with the precession of the perihelion of Mercury, right? That, you know, we thought we had a really great gravity model and then really incredibly tiny anomalies. And then it turned out that, whoa, we got an entirely new theory of physics emerges that explains these tiny discrepancies, you know. That's why I'm always excited when these things endure for this long.
I mean, there's some sort of conceptual ways that we think about things that I get less and less satisfied with, like with quantum fields, right? If I think of like a boson as an excitation in a boson field, I don't like that.
Why not?
I don't like this layering of all the fields. It's starting to seem artificial to me. Now, if you just say that that's a way of saying that we have a bunch of individual particles, because they're quantum particles, you know, technically they're all sort of intermixed as far as their wave functions are concerned, you know, that's not too much of an issue. You know, it is a little bit of an issue, but it's not a big issue. That's a way to say, you know, there is no real difference between a field and a particle. They're just different aspects of the same thing, right? Like a phonon is an elementary excitation of a heat wave, right? So that's fine, right? But if you take that seriously, I mean, it just feels too artificial to have all of these fields, and why do you have all of these interpenetrating fields going around when some of them interact and some of them don't and stuff like that? We don't explain any of that, right? The standard model doesn't explain any of that. It just sort of says if it follows these symmetries, it does.
I was thinking similar lines when I was looking at how they're calculating the exact muon magnetic moment and all these contributions they get from like the vacuum polarization and things. Because, you know, we've talked in the past about how there seems to be two ways of looking at it. You know, you can either look at it as there really are these all-pervasive fields of all these different types throughout the entire cosmos, that these particles are just excitations in these pre-existing fields. And that's really the most popular way of talking about it that I see, at least in the press, you know. But then you find some really convincing arguments from, you know, academic physicists who are looking at this, and they're like, no, that's just a way of thinking about the noise that's in actually physical fields. So when you have this extremely strong magnetic field and the muons going through it and everything, that magnetic field has these quantum properties that can be viewed as like virtual particles, but that might just be kind of an easy perturbative theory kind of way of looking at it to deal with it mathematically. But I tend to agree with you. Like when I think about quantum field theory, I prefer to think about the actual physical fields, actual electric charges, actual magnetic fields, and having certain intrinsic noises that are, you know, related to their intensity and that kind of thing. It seems weird to try to just kind of say that, you know, there is no such thing as empty space and that these fields permeate the entire universe, I guess, equally, but they get excitations in certain places and not others, you know, and then there's a certain noise level everywhere else. You know, I just really wonder, like, if you could go to a deep void, one of the bubbles in the cosmos where there's, you know, almost no matter in fields or anything, you know, would you actually detect these kind of fluctuations happening in empty space if you didn't have like a field generating, you know, to you know, right there present to oscillate? So I don't know. I'm kind of with you on this. I'm a pragmatist, and it seems like it's a lot easier to look at it as quantum field theories, as noises in existing fields instead of like these all pervasive fields in the universe.
Yeah, I have to find that episode like where we talked about a paper that referred to a book that built everything out of the vacuum fluctuations. Because the more I think about that, the more I want to actually read how he does that.
And then we'd seen that paper that we talked about, I think it was Robert Griffiths, who had said that the Casimir effect actually isn't vacuum fluctuations, but rather can be modeled by this dipolar molecular electric field interaction. And he said that you could get any one-loop quantum effect that way. But yeah, I mean, it seems like we keep running into this idea, and it just feels mystical, you know. And I just don't like the mysticism of physics, I guess. I'm a pragmatist, you know. But if they're right, they're right. I'll bow to it if the arguments can be made decisively. It just seems like it hasn't been made decisively.
Okay, I just lost all my friends. Okay, but anyway. I'm sorry for ranting like that at the end.
That's cool. You can alienate all the friends you want, Jim. I'm happy to ride with you.
I mean, one of the reasons why I edit these myself instead of going for a professional editor.
The professional editor is going to keep that, thinking that you would be mad if he cut out something that you enjoyed talking about or something, right?
That's right. And I can cut this out and I can give it to the patrons on Patreon and they can get me ranting about none of this makes sense. They need some real physics instead of just, you know, some stupid models.
That's the meat, man.
That's right. So do you have anything else to talk about muons?
No, I think we've covered it, and we're just gonna have to wait and see what the experiments say, because I think the theorists have their prediction down as fine as they can get it, and now it's just up to the experimentalists to get us a number and see what kind of sigma level we end up with.
Fortunately, the way we've been editing, this podcast will probably come out before they make that prediction. That means everybody gets to wait just like we do.
Yeah. Okay. Hang on tight, people.
All right. Okay. Thanks for talking, Randy.
My pleasure, Jim. Be well.
Okay. Bye now. You have been listening to Physics Frontiers, episode number 56, The Anomalous Magnetic Moment of a Muon. Show notes for this episode can be found at frontiers.physicsfm.com/56. Show notes include the papers we read for this podcast, as well as links to previous episodes that I think are related, and other things that we may have mentioned in the podcast. Bye now. Be safe.